Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
Certains pensent que le métavers n'est qu'un monde virtuel. Mais un jour, les pompiers utiliseront la réalité augmentée pour s'orienter plus rapidement dans des bâtiments en feu et gagner de précieuses secondes quand des vies seront en jeu. Les médecins utiliseront le métavers pour voir les scanners et prendre des décisions plus vite aux urgences. Et même si les mammouths laineux ont disparu, les élèves pourront retourner à la période glaciaire dans le métavers pour leur rendre visite. Même si le métavers est virtuel, son impact sera réel.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Alex Ritson, and in the early hours of Friday, the 10th of March, these are our main stories. Spending big and taxing big. Joe Biden lays out his stance on America's future finances. A mass shooting leaves several dead in the German city of Hamburg. And more big anti-government demonstrations in Georgia despite a government climb down.
We don't really want to be part of Russia, and Georgia is against it, actually.
And we hope tomorrow Georgian people will be free from Russian government of our country.
Also in this podcast, the Ugandan bill that seeks to penalise LGBTQ people. And good news as the UN secures a ship to remove oil from a huge tanker that's been languishing off the coast of Yemen for years, threatening environmental disaster. President Biden has been laying out his stance on America's budget. It envisages spending big and, to pay for that, taxing big. But he's well aware that there'll be many opposing his plans. Indeed, because of Republican opposition, he knows his proposals are unlikely to get very far. Here's a little of him on big business.
When I got elected, there were roughly, don't hold me the exact number because it varies, around 650 billionaires in America. Now there's over 1,000. You know what the average tax they pay, federal tax? 3%. No billionaire should be paying a lower tax than somebody working as a school teacher or a firefighter or any of you in this room. So my plan is to make sure the corporations begin to pay their fair share.
Our North America correspondent, Neda Torfik, told me more about what Mr. Biden had to say.
Well, look, President Biden clearly had re-election in mind because he continually went back to this theme of contrasting his vision, which he said was for ordinary Americans to give the working people a fighting chance, to what he called MAGA Republicans who are tied to President Trump. So we heard there him saying that those who are wealthy, corporations have to pay their fair share. He said Republicans refuse to raise taxes on the wealthiest people. He also kind of turned around their argument that the Democrats just spend too much, saying that the Republicans haven't put forward their own spending plan, but what he knows of it shows that while his plan would reduce the deficit by $3 trillion over a decade, theirs would explode the deficit. And then he went into just all of the different wide-ranging social programs he wants to expense, saying that if they invest in climate, lowering drug prices, getting American youth educated, and leading the world in manufacturing and supply chains, that will all generate growth and save money in the long term.
And yet he knows the Republican majority in the House are very unlikely to pass this.
Absolutely. And I mean, we've heard already from Republicans saying that this is dead on arrival, essentially. But this is a wish list for President Biden. So it gives a starting point for those negotiations. What we heard from the Senate majority leader, because Democrats do hold the majority in the Senate, Chuck Schumer of New York said that the ball is now in the Speaker of the House's court, that he has to put forward what his spending cuts are. And what we saw during the State of the Union speech when President Biden talked about Republicans threatening to cut entitlement programs, Republicans really got upset with that. Again, he's holding them to how do you make a budget that doesn't cut these programs?
Neda Torfik. Thousands of Georgians demonstrated for a third day on Thursday, despite the government announcing that it was dropping a proposed law which critics said would stifle opposition. Under the plans, non-government groups and media organisations would have to register as foreign agents if more than 20% of their funding came from abroad. A majority of parliamentarians from the governing Georgian Dream Party had backed the Prime Minister, Irakli Garibashvili. But he was opposed by the President, Salome Zurabashvili, who said the U-turn was a victory for democracy.
I want to congratulate the whole of society on this first victory of its kind. I welcome these correct steps taken by the government, the fact that they announced the withdrawal of this draft law.
Opposition parties say they will continue to hold demonstrations until Georgia follows a pro-Western course and not a Russian course. Our Russia editor, Steve Rosenberg, spent the day in the capital, Tbilisi.
Well, I'm outside the Georgian Parliament building where protesters have gathered again, even though 2 days of mass protests have forced what appears to be a major concession from the ruling party. Earlier today, it agreed to withdraw the controversial Foreign Agents Bill. Now, this draft law had sparked a lot of anger in Georgia, where many feared it would be used, as similar laws have been in Russia, to silence dissent and to crush civil society. As well as the Georgian flags in the crowd, there are lots of Ukrainian flags being waved, and also flags of the European Union, because polls show the vast majority of Georgian citizens favour EU membership. And protesters here have been accusing their government of trying to derail Georgia's journey into Europe and of being pro-Moscow rather than pro-EU.
We don't really want to be part of Russia and everything they're doing. The whole Georgia is against it, actually.
And we hope tomorrow Georgian people will be free from Russian government of our country. We want more integration in Europe.
In many ways, I think what has happened in Georgia this week and what is happening now in Ukraine are a part of the same picture. Both countries were part of the Soviet Union in Moscow's orbit. And more than 30 years after the fall of the USSR, the consequences of that geopolitical earthquake, the disintegration of the Soviet Empire, are still being felt across the region. We see Russia trying to reassert power and influence in what it sees as its own backyard. And we see people, societies, turning away from Russia, seeing their future as part of Europe.
Steve Rosenberg. Police in the northern German city of Hamburg say several people have been killed in a shooting incident. Several others were injured. Hamburg police said a large-scale operation was underway in the Alsterdorf area. Pierre Vickery told me more about what happened.
It started at about 9 p.m. local time in a fairly leafy, fairly wealthy district of Hamburg. Calls to the police and to firefighters that shots had been heard around a Jehovah's Witness hall in the city. We now know that seven people are dead. We know that at least eight are wounded, some seriously. A command centre has been set up by the police, heavily armed police, a lot of ambulances on the scene, doctors, emergency doctors, etc., all doing their job. We don't know the motive, and what we are waiting for is more information on those who have been responsible. They're saying the person or the people involved, so they don't even know how many shooters they were. And at the moment, that is pretty much what we do know as this story develops.
And briefly, the shooters are still at large.
They are certainly at large. People have been told to stay in their homes. There is concern, of course, what might come next. So the warning to everybody is stay in your homes and await further developments.
Pierre Vickery. Nearly 2 weeks after dozens of migrants were killed off the south coast of Italy, the right-wing Prime Minister, Giorgia Meloni, has held a cabinet meeting near the site of the fatal shipwreck. The boat had set off from Turkey carrying Afghans, Iranians, Pakistanis, Syrians and people from other countries. At least 72 people died. Many of them were children. Critics of Ms. Meloni claim the rescue may have been delayed, something her government denies. She had this to say after the cabinet meeting.
Cioè io non intendo e noi non intendiamo replicare.
I do not intend, and we do not intend, to replicate the approach of those who have let the traffickers of death to act undisturbed over the years. We will do whatever needs to be done to fight and stop these criminals.
Our Europe regional editor, Danny Eberhardt, told me the choice of location for the meeting has reignited feelings.
The emotions in the air are very raw. There are still survivors from the shipwreck. There are relatives who've come to collect bodies. Bodies are still even being washed up. It's not clear how many people were on the boat. Lots of local people, they themselves say that they too are in mourning after this tragedy. Some people were protesting as the cabinet met in this town of Cutro. Now, Ms. Maloney said it was the first time a cabinet meeting had been held where a migrant tragedy had taken place. And she said it was symbolic from that level, but it was also a concrete signal on how focused her government is on the issue of migration.
So what did they decide?
Well, the main thing, as you heard in that clip there, was the message that people smugglers, according to Mrs. Maloney, are the ones to blame for the deaths. That's her firmest message. And she is going to fight the criminal gangs. So one of the measures she introduced is punishing people traffickers up to 30 years in jail for those that are responsible for deaths and serious injuries. That's an extraterritorial law as well. So they will be able to apply even to crimes that took place outside of Italy's normal jurisdiction. And she also talked about Europe. She said she wants immediate action to help fight these gangs. There's a lot of arguments in Europe, obviously, about the migration issue. And she said something else as a bit of a carrot. She said that basically countries of origin that helped Italy with a campaign to inform local people of the risks of going with people traffickers would receive preferential quotas for legal migrant workers. So that was what she was dangling countries to help out.
Ms. Maloney was elected on a platform of bringing down the numbers of migrants. Can she succeed?
That's a good question. I mean, numbers have been going up over the last couple of years. We'll have to see. Basically, a lot of people accuse Miss Maloney of actually being responsible for some of the deaths at sea herself, restrictions, for example, on the activities of charity rescue ships. So it's a very, very heated issue.
Danny Eberhardt. One of the documentaries nominated for an Oscar this weekend is The Martha Mitchell Effect. It's about the woman married to John Mitchell in the 1970s, America's Attorney General under President Richard Nixon. But Martha Mitchell was anything but a quiet political spouse. She was independent-minded, flamboyant even, and during the Watergate scandal, she was very fond of giving journalists the inside track from the Nixon White House. Vincent Dowd has been talking to the film's makers.
Martha Mitchell hit this town like a bombshell.
She is getting to be known as the unguided missile.
But I do say what I please.
She was the first to say Nixon should resign.
When in 1969 John Mitchell became US Attorney General, his wife Martha wasn't a public figure, and she seemed a Republican Party loyalist. That all changed after the Watergate scandal began in Washington in the summer of 72.
The Washington Post reported today that the FBI has established that high Republican officials had ordered a major political campaign of spying and sabotage against the Democrats. The Democratic National Headquarters was bugged with electronic surveillance equipment. That was the so-called Watergate affair.
The two filmmakers bringing Martha Mitchell back into the spotlight at the Oscars are Anne Alverghe and Deborah McClutchie.
Anne and I both first heard of Martha on a podcast called Slow Burn in America and had never heard Martha's story before and thought this is a ripe story to retell in a cinematic way.
It wasn't that the president didn't like women. He didn't like loud women.
He was negligent in being president.
The producers mined resources, mainly at the Nixon Library in California, to bring together their story of Martha Mitchell's role in exposing how Richard Nixon and his colleagues organized an illegal campaign to guarantee that in 1972 he was re-elected as president. The larger-than-life Martha Mitchell comes over as a natural performer.
She was a Southern belle. She loved the spotlight, and the spotlight loved her. And she did like her drink, and she had a bit of an outlandish personality at times.
All of a sudden, these rumors start flying out of the White House.
I'll tell them all. And you know what they're going to do? They'll probably end up killing me.
After the break-in at the Democrats' office in the Watergate building, one of those under investigation was John Mitchell, who later served 19 months in jail for conspiracy and perjury. In 1972, Martha Mitchell was briefing journalists in his defence, often in late-night phone calls.
Did she speak out against the president because she had this high moral compass? But I also think she was trying to protect her husband from being thrown under the bus. Even today, for someone to cross party lines and speak truth to power, that says a lot.
But Martha leaking information to undermine the president created huge pressure for John Mitchell.
He couldn't control his wife. You see in a clip, John Mitchell says she's become her unguided missile. Then later on, that became a liability.
In August 1974, Richard Nixon resigned.
To leave office before my term is completed is abhorrent to every instinct in my body. But as president, I must put the interests of America first.
Ann Alverghe says they're telling a story of what, 50 years later, might be called gaslighting. The men around Martha Mitchell ganging up to persuade her that her perception was wrong.
We hope that we have changed minds and opinions of an older generation that perhaps initially dismissed her because the mainstream media did her as that. I mean, essentially, this is a case study in gaslighting. Hopefully, that's the takeaway lesson.
Ann Alverghe, ending that report by Vincent Dowd. Still to come in the Global News podcast.
I am Mae Muller and I am representing the UK in this year's Eurovision. Yeah.
We meet the UK's Eurovision entry. The authorities in Ukraine are working to restore power to parts of the country after Russia damaged energy infrastructure in a massive overnight bombardment, the heaviest in a month. Ukraine's military says Russia fired nearly 90 missiles and drones. The Russian attacks make normal life impossible and yet seem to do nothing to advance Russian President Vladimir Putin's attempt to gain more territory. Evan Davis spoke to the mayor of Kyiv, Vitaly Klitschko, who was heavyweight boxing champion of the world, but is now leader of a city enduring so much.
My personal opinion, it's not a special operation. It's not a war. It's terrorism to send the rockets to civilians, to kill children, women, old people.
Do you still think he thinks he might take Kyiv? Because I know you have thought in the past that he hadn't given up on the city, on the whole country, really.
Definitely, Kyiv has symbolic status. It's the heart of the country. Russians want very much occupy Kyiv. 1 year ago, the Russians was in the border of our hometown. But to be honest, we was not prepared for this war. We everybody hope it's the war not happens. Already successfully, 1 year we defend Ukraine, and I doubt the Russians have military resources to come to Kyiv and occupy the capital of Ukraine.
Do you worry that this is going to be a never-ending conflict, that the West will give arms to Ukraine to defend and stop Russia advancing, but not enough arms for you to get Russia out of Ukraine, and so the war just rumbles on?
Everybody hope this year, 2023, this war will be stopped. Actually, everything depends from the man who begin this war. He sit in Kremlin, Moscow. His idea to rebuild Soviet empire, for him, much more important than lives of millions of the people. As former fighter, I tell you, his power and size, it's not so important. Much more important than the spirit and will to win. We Ukrainian defend our homes, our homeland. And that way we win this war.
The way you're speaking, Vitaly Klitschko, doesn't make me think you would accept talks or any deal with Russia in which they keep anything.
They occupied big part of our homeland. We're ready to sit in round table and talking about compromise. But when the last Russian soldier left Ukraine, right now, it's a tricky game. We don't believe Russians.
Vitaly, I wonder if I can ask how much personal difficulty you have faced during this last year of war.
I don't care about my personally. I'm responsible for safety of millions of people. Every day, if someone come to me and try to complain, I tell to him, please go to the military hospitals. Look in the boys. There's no arms, no legs with heavy injuries. And please stop to complain. You drive hours long in the country. You see a lot of villages and cities empty. There's no one building without damages. Everything destroyed. And behind every windows, family homeless somewhere. Displaced, no jobs. Don't ask what your country do it for you. Please tell what you can do it for your country. And we do it everything what we can to bring the peace back to Ukraine.
Vitaly Klitschko speaking to Evan Davis. A bill has been tabled in the Ugandan parliament that would criminalise people identifying as LGBTQ. The law would also ban funding or promoting gay and transgender activities. Same-sex relations are banned in about 30 African countries. Asuman Basil Iwa is the Member of Parliament who tabled the bill.
Across the country, there is an outcry of homosexual-related issues, promotion in schools, and there is public concern. So we cannot just look on as a legislature when there is public outcry.
Frank Mugisha is an LGBTQ activist. He says misinformation is circulating.
Some members of parliament have radicalized Ugandans and indoctrinated them that homosexuals are after your children. Already we've been seeing people getting violated. We've registered so many cases of violations. Issues of trauma and mental health is on the increase in the LGBTQ community. We've seen so many cases of arrest, blackmail and extortion. So this is going to go on the increase.
Our correspondent in Uganda, Patience Atuheri, has more.
The proposed law prescribes a 10-year jail term for anyone who engages in a same-sex relationship or marriage. Consent will not be a defense. Gay sex with a minor could also land someone in prison for 10 years. The proposed legislation criminalizes the funding, promotion or support towards any homosexual activities, while landlords who rent premises to sexual minorities also face imprisonment. The bill will be scrutinized by a parliamentary committee before it is tabled before the House again for debate. There has been rising anti-gay sentiment in Uganda and neighboring countries in recent weeks. Activists are concerned that this could lead to mob attacks on anyone suspected to be gay. In 2014, the country's constitutional court nullified the Anti-Homosexuality Act, which prescribed life imprisonment for same-sex relations on the basis that it had been passed by parliament without the required quorum. Legislation that criminalizes sex between people of the same gender already exists in the country's Penal Code Act.
Patience Atuheri in Uganda. Israel's President Isaac Herzog has again stepped into the row ripping apart his country. The proposals by Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's right-wing government to overhaul the judiciary. In a televised address, Mr. Herzog called on Mr. Netanyahu to abandon them in favour of plans that had the broad support of Israelis.
To the leaders of the state, to the coalition and the government at its head, I say we are at the point of no return. It is a moment of to be or not to be. To choose agreement and to achieve a foundational constitutional moment that will enable us to thrive and grow for years and generations to come, or to slide into a constitutional, security, social and economic abyss.
Earlier, there were further protests against Mr. Netanyahu. Demonstrators in Tel Aviv stopped him reaching Ben-Gurion Airport by car. Instead, he took a helicopter so he could board a plane for a trip to Italy. Our correspondent Tom Bateman reports.
Well, this is the Ayalon Highway. It's the main road that runs north-south in Tel Aviv. The protesters, they breached the road. Police have been trying to stop them. They came down here, jumped over the fence. We followed them over as we were filming. They got onto the road and blocked it. Now, this is exactly what Israel's far-right police minister, Itamar Ben-Gvir, said he wouldn't accept. He calls these protesters anarchists. You can hear them chanting for democracy. Now, we watched as the mounted police came along the street. The protesters dug in. Dozens of them were sitting on the road. And at that point, they pushed them back. So what is this all about? This is about the new nationalist Israeli government led by Benjamin Netanyahu pushing through a series of judicial reforms that would, its critics say, strip Israel's Supreme Court of its independence and would stack the judiciary in favour of the government. It has led to increasing protests over the weeks. The government, for its part, says that they're just trying to restore the balance between the executive and the judiciary, but that is not abnormal, but it's led to increasing tension and increasing clash here over the future of this country.
Tom Bateman. The United Nations says that it's been able to secure a tanker that can take and store 1.1 million barrels of oil from a decaying vessel off the coast of Yemen. The vessel has been threatening environmental disaster for years. Our Arab Affairs editor Sebastian Usher reports.
The UN Development Agency says that it's made a major breakthrough in trying to avert the potential catastrophe posed by the FSO Safa, which has lain abandoned off the port of Hodeidah since 2015. For years, there have been warnings that the giant supertanker is a time bomb that could break up at any moment, releasing a vast quantity of oil into the sea. Efforts to avert disaster have been hampered by continued fighting in Yemen and the huge expense of a solution. But those issues appear to have been resolved, with the Houthi rebels who control Hodeidah allowing salvage work to go ahead and the UN now signing a contract to secure a tanker to store the oil. The work could cost more than $140 million, but that's dwarfed by the $20 billion salvage operation that would be needed if an oil spill were to occur.
Sebastian Usher. A 25-year-old singer from London has been announced as the UK's entry for this year's Eurovision Song Contest. May Muller will perform her catchy number, I Wrote a Song, at the competition in Liverpool in May. Our Eurovision reporter Daniel Rosny heard the winner being revealed on a BBC radio station this morning.
Mystery pop star, please reveal yourself!
Hello, I am May Muller and I am representing the UK in this year's Eurovision! Yeah!
May Muller's song is about female empowerment and getting her own back on an ex-boyfriend. She'll perform it in front of 160 million viewers, no pressure. She'll fly the flag for the UK with this. Instead I wrote a song. The 25-year-old has previously supported girl band Little Mix on tour and is hoping to follow in the successful footsteps of Sam Ryder, who came second last year.
He's given me some little tips and shared some of his wisdom with me already, but he's like very busy because he's, you know, about to take over the world and go on tour and stuff, but he's just been so supportive already.
The BBC's used the same management company as it did in 2022 to find an artist for the song contest. Anna Neville is from Tap Management.
She's such a super ambassador for the UK in this competition.
37 songs will compete at May's event in Liverpool, which is hosting it on behalf of last year's winners, Ukraine. May's convinced British Eurovision fans she's got what it takes.
Yeah, I can hear it like going viral on TikTok.
We've been begging for quality, and last year we've got it.
But now the challenge is to convince the rest of Europe. Instead, I
wrote a song. May in May. Daniel Rosny with that report. And that's almost all from us for now. There'll be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. But before we go, Andrew Peach has been telling me what's coming up in the Happy Pod this weekend.
Imagine if you felt that the rest of the world had a very different and more negative view of your home country than you do. We're going to talk to a guy who's in Pakistan, who's been posting absolutely beautiful photographs of the scenery of Pakistan because he wants to change the world's perception of his country, he says. I'm going to talk to one of the people who was cheering at the UN in New York earlier in the week, where after 20 years of talks, they finally did the deal with the UN High Seas Treaty. What does it feel as the person who's devoted so many years of their life to negotiating to get to the point of euphoric agreement? And then what do you do next? And the highlight is we've got a 9-year-old listener in Quito in Ecuador who sent us a voice note of why she's already enjoying that collection of happy news. So what we've done is created an extra bonus episode of the Global News podcast. It arrives every Saturday and it rounds up the week's happy news. And I'm really pleased to say we're getting lots of emails from GNP listeners who are enjoying it.
Yeah, you've had some extraordinary feedback to the first episode, haven't you?
We've had some lovely emails from people in France, in the US, in Ecuador listening. You know, sometimes the world can feel a bit of a depressing place, but there's all sorts of joyous and positive things happening as well. And quite a lot of the stories, I think, are starting to come from our listeners, which is really interesting. Listeners are emailing with their feedback. Sometimes they have suggestions of how we might tweak it a little bit, or they say they like it, which is lovely to hear. But also people are telling us about things happening in their part of the world, and we've got some of those coming up in the next few weeks. But finding the stories isn't proving as hard as I thought it might be. People warm to the concept of wanting a little podcast once a week that you can listen to on a run, or when you're making a recipe in your kitchen, or and life feels perhaps a little bit more relaxed, that might cheer you up.
This edition of the Global News Podcast was mixed by Daphne Evans, and the producer was Emma Joseph. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Alex Ritson. Until next time, goodbye.